I'm Nicole Austin Hillary, and I serve as the director and counsel of the Washington office of the Brennan Center for Justice. On behalf of the Brennan Center, we are pleased that you've joined us this afternoon for what we know will be an exciting and interesting conversation on presidential ethics law. And this is a particularly good moment to have that discussion. The Brennan Center, for those of you who don't know, is a nonpartisan law and policy institute that seeks to improve our broken systems of justice and democracy. And we like to use the tools of advocacy, research, litigation, and strategic communications to do just that. We work on what we think are very cutting-edge issues such as voting rights, money in politics, ethics, criminal justice reform, racial justice, fair courts, and a host of other issues to, again, do just that, make our democracy and justice systems stronger and more effective for all Americans. Please follow the Brennan Center, if you don't already, on Facebook and Twitter. Be sure to check out our videos and podcasts on iTunes, YouTube, and in the multimedia section of BrennanCenter.org. And with that said, I am pleased to introduce our moderator for today's program, Kimberly Atkins, who's the chief Washington reporter and political columnist for the Boston Herald. Please join me in welcoming Kimberly.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you so much, Nicole. President Donald Trump's decision to keep control of his business empire, despite apparent conflicts of interest, is but one of a number of ethical controversies that have made headlines since Inauguration Day a year ago. As informal guardrails that constrain self-dealing by those in power fall by the wayside, what can be done to shore up federal ethics laws to give the public confidence that their leaders will put the interests of the American people first? What are the most significant gaps that exist in our system of federal ethics regulation? What are the special challenges that accompany any effort to regulate the president's conduct in office? And what are the most promising ideas for reform? Those are the questions that we are going to be tackling today with our esteemed panel of guests, including Kathleen Clark, professor of law at the Washington University School of Law, Walter Schaub, the ethics director at the Campaign Legal Center and former director of the Office of Government Ethics, and Daniel Wiener, the senior counsel of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. Welcome to the Brennan Center of Justice here at NYU, D.C. Okay, and so, and again, my name is Kimberly Atkins, and I am a political columnist and reporter for the Boston Herald. So I want to start off our discussion, and I also wanted to note in the beginning, we will have time at the end for questions, so keep them, hold them tight, and we will come to that a little bit later. But I want to start out talking about the background of federal ethics laws and how do they apply to the president?
Well, that is a good question. Some federal ethics laws apply to the president, but one of the most important, which is the federal prohibition on conflicts of interest, does not. And that exemption dates back to the late 80s, although it was implied before. Now, what's interesting, of course, and most folks know this, is that historically, presidents, notwithstanding that they were not prohibited from having conflicts of interest, took voluntary steps, sometimes quite elaborate steps, to avoid them nonetheless. And usually that took the form, and my co-panelists here will correct me if I'm wrong, because they've worked in this space longer than I have, but they usually took the form either of limiting the types of assets they held to, you know, diversified mutual funds, bank accounts, that sort of thing, or placing other types of assets in a blind trust, and in which it was really shielded from both their control and, crucially, their knowledge. So that is a key element of the federal ethics regime that does not apply to the president. Other rules, including, for instance, prohibitions on bribery, nobody has ever suggested they don't. On the other hand, we've never really proven that because the president has never been prosecuted. But I think most of us would agree that presidents can't take bribes, and they do have to disclose some. But there are significantly fewer constraints than for virtually every other federal official other than the vice president.
And so, Walter, talk a little bit about the rules that sort of were put in place along the way to complement and supplement the existing legal framework when it comes to regulating ethics.
Sure. So with regard to the president.
With regard to the president, yes.
So it's true that the president is not covered by the primary criminal conflict of interest statute. But the way I look at that is, it means that the law doesn't impose a criminal penalty for the president's conflicts of interest. But that doesn't mean, as the president asserted a little more than a year ago, that a president can't have conflicts of interest. The president obviously can have a conflict of interest because it's anything that creates a financial interest that runs contrary to the duties of your position. And a president can certainly do that, and we've seen this president do that. It's not entirely true that no laws cover the president with regard to conflicts of interest or ethics in general. Technically, the president is covered by the ethics gift rules, although OGE has, the Office of Government Ethics has created an exception for the president that allows him to accept certain gifts. Interestingly, though, in the past year, it became effective January 1st, but was approved and issued as a final rule in November prior to that in 2016. OGE created a new requirement that you should consider if you can accept a gift because an exception applies, should you accept it? And would it create a concern on the part of a reasonable person who had knowledge of the relevant facts as to whether or not this would impede your impartiality in your decision-making or lead you to give greater access to someone. I don't suspect for a second that that's actually being applied, but it should be, and good government groups and reporters and the public should be asking, if they see him accept a gift, what was your analysis in applying those factors? Another obscure provision that applies to the president is that in 2012, Congress passed the STOCK Act, the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act, and it was somewhat incorrectly reported that that law had been rescinded. It has not been rescinded. It's in place. One transparency provision in it was curtailed and rolled back a bit. But the law was originally a response to a 60 Minutes piece that suggested members of Congress were profiting from their position by engaging in trades around the time that laws were being passed and other decisions were being made. And it was initially intended to apply only to the legislative branch. And President Obama called on Congress and sort of shamed them in his State of the Union speech, saying, you should pass it. Well, that prompted a reaction where they then extended its coverage to the executive branch and said, oh, yeah, well, we'll pass it all right. And it became like a Christmas tree with people hanging ornaments on it because there were 30 different amendments added in the final 2 weeks or so. One of the provisions defined the president as an employee, and that means all of the new restrictions that imposed on employees apply to the president. And one of the restrictions was a requirement under Section 17 of the STOCK Act to recuse from any particular matter affecting the financial interests of anyone who you have an arrangement with for future employment or compensation or are negotiating for one of those. And that's interesting because it imposes a recusal requirement on the president. And as we'll discuss later, that has been the subject of some constitutional debate as to whether or not Congress can impose a recusal requirement on the president. But in fact, they have. It just hasn't been challenged because nobody's tried to assert its coverage. But that was a crossing of a threshold, and I don't know that they did it deliberately, but as with any legislative history, you have to assume that they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah. So let's, well.
Bold assumption.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit broadly about what's missing, about what some of the loopholes in these rules as you laid them out are. Kathleen, can you give us an overview of that?
I can, but before I do that, I also just want to emphasize that the country's first conflict of interest law does apply to the president, and that's conflict of interest provisions that are found in the United States Constitution, the Foreign Emoluments Clause and the Domestic Emoluments Clause. Those indicate that the president or any government official is prohibited from accepting something of value from a foreign government. That, of course, has been the subject of some litigation What I think that represents is that our framers recognized the danger that government officials, including the president, could be influenced by money or anything of value that they received. Now, in terms of exceptions or problems that need to be filled, I think that the what Dan identified, the fact that in 1989, Congress amended the criminal financial conflict of interest statute so that it exempted the president and the vice president from its reach. I believe that was a mistake, and I think that if we go back a couple of more decades, back to 1962, when President Kennedy was submitting a comprehensive set of ethics reforms before Congress, President Kennedy included in that an exemption for the president and the vice president. Congress rejected it, and from 1962 on, imposed on the president and the vice president the financial conflict statute. So that's one thing that I think Congress, when we get a Congress that cares again about our founding principles and about conflicts of interest and protecting the public trust, when we get that Congress, I think that Congress needs to reenact this financial criminal conflict of interest provision on the president. The other thing I want to mention is another problem in the conflict of interest standards or our ethics standards. And this is a process issue rather than a substantive standard. Government officials, high-level officials, are required by statute to fill out somewhat detailed forms about their financial interests. But the statute has been interpreted so that if a government official has a company, a business, the official does not need to disclose the debts and financial relationships mm-hmm. of that company. Well, we have a president who, of course, has hundreds of LLCs. And as the Office of Government Ethics has interpreted the statute, the disclosure statute, he was not required to disclose the financial relationships of those LLCs, including the debts owed by those LLCs, by those companies. So we have an income, our financial disclosure laws are probably adequate for perhaps many of the people in the room, for someone like myself of modest means, but they're not adequate to deal with someone who's using, who has their own companies, because it doesn't, it's been interpreted not to require disclosures. So for someone like Trump, for someone like Jared Kushner, we need to change the laws so that we can get visibility into the financial connections, including the debts of their own companies.
And can I just add one thing really quickly? So in addition to the not having to disclose the debts, the other sort of wacky thing about disclosure, ethics disclosure is, and Walt and I have discussed this a little bit, is if you ever see, they disclose it in these very broad ranges, like 5 million to 25 million, which for conflict of interest purposes, just to see what your asset is, may be adequate. But one of the things we've looked at is that if you look at other countries, say Italy under Silvio Berlusconi, it wasn't that Silvio Berlusconi was necessarily directly taking government action to benefit his media empire, although he was to some extent. But it was also a pattern of rent-seeking businesses and sectors of industry buying advertising at inflated prices at his companies and increasing their value. And that was actually probably the primary way he enriched himself off of being prime minister of Italy. And we saw the same thing to some extent with the Kirchners, who were the husband and wife president of Argentina, who actually owned a chain of hotels that the government did business at. So when you have these broad ranges, it obscures the extent to which certain assets might be increasing in value for reasons other than just the market. And, you know, obviously Mar-a-Lago, for instance, made $7 million bucks more during the most recent period than it did before the president became president. He actually disclosed that, interestingly, on his report, but that's a good example. Maybe Mar-a-Lago is a more attractive place to you know, play and be a member now that it's run by the President of the United States. And that's something that really the forms would not necessarily reveal right now.
And I want to sort of take one step back from this mm-hmm. point and just really pose to the panel, why should we care about these issues? Why do we care about conflicts of interest? I know there are a lot of supporters of the president that say he's a good businessman. He mm-hmm. has the right to make money. We knew he was a businessman when he was elected. So sort of identify why we have these conflict of interest laws and why we care about them.
So if I can do that, if I could just go back over a couple of the points that we
sure.
just did. Kathleen knows she and I disagree on one point, but it's a cheerful professional disagreement. I don't agree that the 1962 law applied to the president, and so I don't think it's a matter of going back to what was prior to the 1989 amendment. I think it was understood at the time that the criminal conflict of interest statute did not apply to the president, and of course in 1974, Lawrence Silberman, writing on behalf of the Department of Justice, wrote an opinion articulating that, and OGE cited that opinion again in 1983. And so I think by 1989, when they put that in there, I think there was some nervousness at the tail end of the Reagan administration about consequences for some alleged issues. But I don't think anybody seriously thought at the time that they were changing the law. I think they thought they were codifying it. In terms of liabilities for companies, you know, I'm the one who certified the president's financial disclosure report, and I stand by that. I think it was compliant to the extent that he disclosed. Now, if we find out he left things off, there'd be no way OGE could know that. I agree with the other two panelists that the laws are inadequate to deal with the situation we're in terms of disclosure, but I think OGE's treatment of privately held companies, saying you don't have to disclose their liabilities or business partners, is consistent with the rest of the application of the statute, because if, for instance, you hold stock in Coca-Cola or Exxon or any other large publicly traded company, you're not necessarily going to know, as just random person who called up your broker and said, buy 5 shares of Coca-Cola and 50 shares of Exxon, what the company's liabilities are or who its affiliates are. And so I think the gap we're seeing is privately held companies, and more specifically privately held family companies, like President Trump's family's companies, Jared Kushner's family's companies, and the nominee to be the head of NOAA, in the Department of Commerce, his name is Barry Myers, who's coming from AccuWeather, which is a very closely held family company. And so I think this is a new problem that we have not had a lot of experience dealing with, and the law hasn't caught up with the fact that now we've got public officials with these privately held companies. And then in terms of the ranges, again, I tend to look at it as a technician. I'm not sure I agree that we need to break the ranges into more pieces, particularly on the value side, because if you have a $1 asset, it's still a conflict of interest unless there's an exemption that applies.
I would just say that it might be more important on the income side. So if you're
sure.
seeing a greatly increased revenue stream, I think that might be more indicative. The valuation, I take your point that that's maybe less important. But I do
and I think if we stripped publicly traded companies out of that, because I'm not sure there's any purpose in knowing income in terms of dividends from a publicly traded company, but these privately held companies, you could see these fluctuations and want to know what that's about. But all of this goes back to why does this matter? And I think at its just most basic core, a question of corruption is whether or not somebody is misusing or abusing the authority entrusted to them for their own personal gain or for the personal gain of some other private individual and or company. And if we have people going into government to enrich themselves or enrich others by using governmental authority, and I'm not talking about collecting your salary, but using government authority that's entrusted to you by the people to be used for their benefit, but you pervert that authority and use it for your own benefit, then that calls into question the legitimacy of government as a concept, much less in the individual case. And that is the hallmark of the countries that we label banana republics or things where the leaders can just help themselves. I mean, there are rumors that Putin has used all of his authoritarian power to perhaps become the richest man in the world, or certainly one of them. And you have to ask yourself, why are we entrusting authority to people? But even beyond the actual misuse, is in a civilized, modern Western society, the sense that we shouldn't even have to ask the question. The burden should be on the government official to take whatever actions they can to show us that there is no remaining conflict of interest. And that's as it should be, because the public can't have access to enough information to know. The link between a financial interest and a decision is very hard to draw. And so it's, in many cases, we find ourselves highlighting the smaller violations that are the canary in the coal mine that tell us that there's a broader rot going on. But in reality, we shouldn't even have to ask, because the government official should be able to say, I've cleared the decks on this and eliminated conflicts of interest, so that you can know that my decisions are based on the policy aims that I declared when you voted for me, rather than on my own personal enrichment or the personal enrichment of a third party.
And we've had presidents who have taken that approach, even though the criminal statute didn't apply to them, until now.
I just want to add, too, I mean, Walt mentioned Russia, and, you know, I'd throw out another example, which is Venezuela, which was actually, people, it's a basket case now, but it was actually a fairly stable, prosperous democracy for many, many years. And people think of Chavez as having changed that, but in fact, Chavez was partly a reaction to the corruption at the top in Venezuela before. And this is not just sort of speculation. There's a vast array of literature that documents the extent to which, you know, perceptions of self-dealing at the top undermine, you know, the public's faith in democratic institutions. And we are seeing a worldwide trend in in reduced faith in democracy, and the United States is not immune to that. The one other thing, just to continue the canary in the coal mine metaphor, ethics, I think, is to some extent indicative of a broader range of democratic concerns. Because if you take sort of the idea that the president can't have the conflict of interest to the extreme, you get, you know, the idea that the president's interests are coterminous with that of the state. Yeah. And that l'état c'est moi, which was what Louis XIV said. And that takes you into a very different political philosophy than the ideals that our country was founded on. So I think these are very important, partly because if you worry about limits on executive power, you worry, you know, you think, I don't want to be, you know, harping on the president's businesses, but I also don't want him to exceed his constitutional authority. The two things are very connected, and we should worry about this if we're worried about the broader array of the presidency and what it means now.
Okay. I want to get to some proposed solutions soon about reform, but before we get there, I want to ask a question. I'll start with you, Kathleen. What are the limits of ethics laws, and what are those limits set by? Is it by the Constitution? Is it by something else?
So the starting point, it seems to me, is the Constitution. And if we take a look at the Foreign and Domestic Emoluments Clauses, that tells us that our founders absolutely were concerned about conflicts, but I think it also helps ground us in something that Dan was alluding to, the idea that our government officials are given public power not so that they can exercise it on behalf of themselves or their family members, but so that they can exercise it on behalf of their vision of the public interest, on behalf of all of us. So at the very heart of the matter is this, I'll use a legal term, fiduciary, that government officials really have obligations to the people, which is foundational. And then the government ethics standards that have been adopted by Congress and then by regulators in enacting regulations through the Office of Government Ethics and otherwise really are expressions of that notion that public office is a public trust. And so at the very heart of it, it's about government officials recognizing and acting as though they owe obligations to us, not just to themselves selfishly. And almost all government ethics regulations, as complicated as they can get, can be connected to this foundational principle that public office is a public trust. And I want to acknowledge that it's not at all clear that this president recognizes that truth. I think he really is challenging that truth. And his challenge to it is consistent with his other sort of anti-democratic, small-d democratic tendencies that we've seen in attacking not just foundational principles like public offices of public trust, but foundational protections for our democracy. It's all of one, it seems to me.
I would like to make a pitch to people who like this president, too, because the next president may not be a billionaire real estate developer. It may be a lefty tech titan from Silicon Valley or a media mogul. And these same restrictions will also apply to that individual as they do apply to this president. So just because you like this president, many people do and understand and respect that, doesn't mean you shouldn't care about this stuff. And every president, I think, tends to forget that the next president may have a very different philosophy and they reject constraints on themselves that they might like for their successors. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
You know, sort of going back to what Kathleen was just saying, I think that's a really good point about it goes to the fundamental purpose for us being a country and having a government. And so the question becomes, do you serve the government or does the government serve you? And if you serve the government, as would be the case in an authoritarian country where the king rules all or the leader rules all, then it might make sense to misuse the criminal investigative apparatus of the state to go after your vanquished political rival and punish them for having dared to run against you. Or if you live in a country where the government exists to serve you, maybe the criminal investigative apparatus is for looking for crimes that are a threat to you right now and not digging up things from the past that go back beyond the statute of limitations in some case. And that's where you see the bleeding over of, well, this is for me, as when they announced they're going to do offshore drilling and they put out a Federal Register notice, and even before the period closes, Secretary Zinke exempts the one state in which the president's premier beachfront property exists, but everybody else has to wait. And so it begins to look like the state is for the benefit of the state and you are all its servants, as opposed to we've come to a social contract that we're going to have a government to protect us in one way or another. And so I think as Dan was emphasizing, the concept of the canary in the coal mine is very broad, because this is an indication of, in many ways, a trend towards authoritarianism, in the sense that this is for my benefit as your leader, as opposed to I'm acting out your wishes.
All right. Just a reminder, this is the Brennan Center for Justice Program at NYU, D.C., and we are talking to Walter Schaub, Senior Director of Ethics at the Campaign Legal Center and former Director of the Office of Governmental Ethics, Kathleen Clark, Professor of Law at the Washington University School of Law, and Dan Wiener, Senior Counsel of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center. I am Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter and Columnist at the Boston Herald. And you can follow the Brennan Center for Justice on Facebook, on Twitter, and watch their programs on YouTube and listen to iTunes podcasts. All of their reports and media are online at BrennanCenter.org. So I want to talk a little bit about solutions or proposed reforms that you all have, but maybe kick it off first with Walter to sort of explain what OGE does and why it seems, at least from my perspective as a reporter covering these issues, that it was developed largely to be self-governing, at least when it comes to the White House. Should there be, and is one of your proposals, tougher enforcement mechanism for OGE or something outside of that?
Well, so the Office of Government Ethics, which I led until this summer, is a prevention tool. Plain and simple. That's what it's here to do. I don't view it as part of the enforcement mechanism. It's part of the prevention mechanism. And so my discussion of where to go from there stems from that, because people come to the Office of Government Ethics or to any of the 4,500 agency ethics officials that it oversees, and proactively ask for advice. And we have nominees coming to OGE, opening up their financial assets and answering very intrusive questions that sometimes go beyond the bounds of what we need strictly for the form in order to just be sure that there isn't anything we're missing that has to be addressed. And by and large, they tend to cooperate, and this prevention mechanism, you know, it's very hard to quantify what's been prevented because you're writing down what hasn't happened. I once said at the beginning of a speech that you don't hear much about ethics when things are going well, and that's precisely as it should be. But you don't see people knocking on the door of an inspector general and say, I'm thinking about doing this thing. Will you investigate me and see that I get thrown in jail if I do it? Nobody goes to the policeman for advice proactively. And so I think OGE has a role in enforcement, which is coordinating with the enforcement entities and delivering information that shows wrongdoing to them. But in terms of the interactive back and forth, I don't think you have that kind of interaction with the level of success that OGE had had for 40 years until this past year, if people are having to report themselves to the policeman to get advice. And so as a result, OGE's authorities are somewhat limited. And I don't necessarily think conceptually that's a terrible thing. I mean, you have to remember that when I was the director of OGE, my immediate supervisor was the president. And I point out to people, I once last year had to fill out a form, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it was, but I had to write the name of my supervisor. And I wrote Donald J. Trump. And I went back there to make sure they knew I wasn't just being a smart aleck. Because he was literally my supervisor. And so that's important to understand, and I think it vividly illustrates the limitations on OGE, because ultimately the things we're seeing, the departures that have occurred in the past year, are the fault of Congress that has refused to exercise the kind of oversight that you can be sure it would have exercised if the other candidate had won. And ultimately, only Congress is going to be able to impose consequences on a president, and the president's employee isn't going to be able to do that. And even if you gave them the authority to do it, he would just fire them before it became effective. We're already having to bite our nails hoping that Mueller doesn't get fired, and that's a criminal investigation, and he's got the power to charge somebody with obstruction of justice. There's no way that anybody's talking about building an OGE that is a special counsel like Mueller. And if you did, then you've made a decision to throw away a prevention mechanism that has prevented a lot of harm. So you have to look at the trade-offs, and I think there's a temptation in a lot of ways to want an easy fix to a complex problem. But my experience in this world is that the world is very nuanced and complex, and easy fixes don't work well for complex problems. And I think along the lines of something Dan said, you know, I made that comment about Congress, and some of the same congressmen who have no interest in looking into anything going on now were asking questions and are still asking questions about what they called pay for play with a nonprofit. But have no, and by the way, that's a fair thing to look at. But how do you look at and have concerns about pay for play with a nonprofit when you have a for-profit with this president that is letting people pay for access to the president and not use that same terminology? And so, you know, the lessons we learned in our civics classes in high school aren't working out because Congress isn't serving as a check. Even when Mueller's done, he's only going to release information that will either lead to somebody being convicted or is exculpatory in nature because he has a constitutional responsibility to share that with the defendant. But beyond that, you're not going to get answers. What we don't have is a 9/11 type commission that's looking at all aspects of what happened in the last election to really dive in and tell us in detail and write a report like this that lays out everything they found that happened last year. That isn't happening because the constitutional check of Congress overseeing the executive branch isn't working when you have one party in charge of all of it. Now, that's not that I'm for one party or against. In fact, I will probably vote against any party having total control ever again, even if it means voting against a candidate I like. Getting back to the fixes then, the question becomes, what do you want to fix? Do you throw away 40 years that seemed to work relatively well and had built upon itself and refined itself to the point where we were doing fine-tuning rather than turning the bigger dial that moved the needle up and down the radio channel, for those of you old enough to remember knobs on a radio? And so the kinds of things I would like to see include, and I shared 13 proposals, and I won't go through all of them, but the kinds of things I would like to see is one way, and you'll hear that we disagree on this panel about some of the fixes. One of the things I'd like to see is, and I think it's in common with them, is some increased protection for the director of the Office of Government Ethics. When I made my stand last year, I was a guy who had student loans, no new job lined up, 19 years of federal service, 1 year short of a magic 20, and thought I was going to be fired at 12:01 on January 20th. So I always get a kick out of the White House's comments that I did this for a profit. It's like, man, I'll trade shoes with you any day. But setting aside their deep, dark cynicism in comments like that, I do think it would be helpful if the director of OGE, like others in government, like inspectors general or the head of the Office of Special Counsel, which is not Mueller's office, but the office that investigates Hatch Act violations and whistleblower retaliation, could only be fired for cause, and Congress had to be given 30 days notice with a written explanation. Something as simple as that. Or I fought a battle with the White House to get some records. OGE has all the authority in the world it needs to gather records and information about ethics, but none of the power. And the difference between authority and power is the authority for a judge to issue an order, and power is the ability to send the U.S. Marshals to your doorstep when you don't comply. OGE has plenty of authority, but no U.S. Marshals on hand. And in terms of investigations, I do think there's a gap in investigative authority because there are a number, dozens, of small agencies that have no inspector general. And you also have the White House among them that's outside the scope of an inspector general. So the proposal I made is create one centralized inspector general that covers all the entities in the executive branch other than the White House that don't have an inspector general, and give the IG full inspector general authority to investigate anything coming out of there the way an IG can, and then special ethics authority to conduct an ethics investigation in the White House or anywhere else in the government for really high-level officials upon referral from OGE. And then that also is a mechanism that prevents abuse, because you could suddenly empower OGE to be an investigative body, and one director is going to make decisions about what to investigate, and you could have the ethics program become a political tool in that case. But having a separate IG who can only conduct a special ethics investigation at the White House or elsewhere upon referral to OGE is like those old 80s war movies with two guys in the missile silo who have to turn the key at the same time from across the room. It means that two have to agree, and they may have been appointed by different presidents in many cases, and so that gives some protection. And then the one other that I'll cover really briefly is my proposal for solving presidential conflicts of interest. I don't think that a president should have to recuse, because I do think we need a president to participate in everything. We can't have a national crisis unfolding with split-second decisions needing to be made and a president saying, can somebody check the file and see if I need to recuse from this and not participate? And there's nobody to give a waiver because he doesn't have a boss. But even if he did, turning over the power of the executive branch. I don't know that I agree with those that say it's a constitutional problem, because as I mentioned earlier, Congress has already imposed a recusal requirement, a very limited circumstance, but I think it's a bad idea, and it's dangerous in the sense that we need the president available for things. So I'd like to get us back to the tradition where presidents voluntarily take as many steps as humanly possible to resolve conflicts of interest voluntarily, And one way that I came up to do this and I proposed to Congress was require them to disclose in writing to the Office of Government Ethics their plan for addressing their conflicts of interest and have OGE post it. That's one piece of it. But the key piece is that it happen before the first primary to decide who's going to be a party's nominee. Because the media failed to ask the questions last fall. They failed to ask Hillary Clinton, what are you going to do with that foundation? And they failed to ask Donald Trump, what are you going to do with all of these companies? But even if they had done that in the fall of 2016, I don't think there are very many people in the world who are going to change parties over that. But if you start asking the question when you have 16 people running for the same party's nomination on the stand, I suspect Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or Chris Christie or Jeb Bush or John Kasich or Ben Carson would have really thrown down with this president over his failure to come up with a plan to resolve conflicts of interest. And some people might have said, oh, that bothers me. I'll vote for this other guy who's going to run for my party's nomination, and I don't have to change parties. And so the idea is disclosure, but disclosure early enough. And then the final piece of it has to be you can amend it at any time in writing and re-release it so that it becomes a race to the top. You come in and bid too low, the next candidate comes in and says, I'm going to do this much more. And you take a beating in a town hall or a debate or something, and you come back and you re-release an even higher plan. And then they compete. And I wonder if that might create enough pressure to get us back to voluntary compliance with divestiture rather than selling, compelling recusal. And the final thing I'll say about that is something Dan said about it cutting both ways also cuts both ways in a bigger sense. He mentioned that if you like Donald Trump, you should be concerned that maybe somebody else will become president and keep their conflicts of interest. Maybe Hillary Clinton will run again and keep her foundation. And just a few years ago, you were chanting, lock her up. But now you have to live with it because you approved it for Donald Trump. But it cuts the same way for the other side, too. There's a number of billionaires and multimillionaires toying with the idea of running. And no matter which party they run for, if they come in and refuse to resolve their conflicts of interest, they have now sealed permanently in place the idea that a president doesn't ever have to worry about their conflicts of interest. And if they take advantage of the fact that they can say, well, the other guy didn't do that, the other party didn't do that, but they come in and do it again, make no mistake about it, they are part of the problem and not part of the solution. And so people need to hold their own party accountable and on both sides put country before party. And I think that's a challenge that we're seeing people fail right now. I hope it stops, and I hope we don't start seeing the same behavior all around.
And I want to go to Dan and Kathleen, too, about some other ideas or counter ideas about solution. But keeping in mind, one question that comes to mind as Walter was talking was, well, if the only way for a president in particular is to take office is for him to completely divest himself of all of his earnings, especially if he has a company the way that President Trump does, put it in a blind trust or some other way, completely divest yourself, why would that dissuade people from running? Is that too much to ask someone to do? And I want you guys to talk about that and also reforms as you see them.
So I personally don't think it's too much to ask to ask a candidate for president to start putting country first. Mm-hmm. And so requiring divestment or requiring a commitment to divest doesn't seem like too much to me. But I also want to just come back to something that Walter Schaub said when you referred to the conflict that the Office of Government Ethics had with the White House back in May, in the spring of 2017. I believe it was with regard to whether the White House was going to discuss or publish and disclose these waivers mm-hmm. that it had issued. And you said that the Office of Government Ethics didn't have much power to compel. And I think that you were right that the Office of Government Ethics didn't have the traditional indicia of power. But what you really masterfully demonstrated is that you had soft power. Mm. And I think that your interactions with the Trump White House with regard to those waivers and otherwise in 2017 is a sort of a case study that really should be studied by students of public administration as well as law.
Perhaps political Congress. Science.
Well, but you not only had the commitment and sort of the right position that the White House should disclose these waivers that pretty much showed that the ethics executive order was a bit of a joke in how it was ultimately used, but you got them to actually make these disclosures because you shamed them into it, which is an amazing accomplishment. That the Office of Government Ethics was able to shame the Office of the White House and the White House Counsel's Office into doing the right thing. And so I just want to highlight, as we think of reforms, that we need to keep in mind that many of these are referred to as guardrails, sort of norms rather than laws, but your really masterful handling of that conflict is something you deserve a lot of credit for, and also is perhaps something that we need to look for ways to cultivate on the part of other accountability mechanisms within and without of government.
And I would add, Congress has a role in that because Congress has used its oversight authority in the past not just to enforce law, to ensure compliance with the law, but also to enforce these unwritten norms. Past presidents, when they violated norms that were against the law, those triggered congressional investigations. So I think Congress does need to have that message reinforced to it. I do disagree, with a couple of things, although I agree with most of it, and I'm kind of trembling at the thought of disagreeing with you about ethics in public.
We've talked about this before.
Right. But two things, and one, I note that we have the longest-serving federal election commissioner here in the audience, Ellen Weintraub, and the FEC... is an example also of the challenges that come with enforcing some of these guardrails and also has the dubious distinction of having to regulate the president, or at least the president's campaign, while he is also technically the commissioner's boss. The FEC has its challenges, but it is doable. And many federal agencies, for instance, have an enforcement division that is walled off from the rest of the agency. I tend to think with the FEC that enforcement division should be more powerful. But there is a way to empower career civil servants to enforce some of these laws with oversight from the political appointees. So I don't think that it's impossible for that to become OGE, but I also respect your point of view as having run OGE, and it doesn't have to be within OGE. It could be.
You don't have to soften it, though.
No, I do, actually. I don't. I think that there is something to be said for a culture of voluntary compliance and for people. Now, a lot of agencies try to, particularly in the financial sector, try to combine, supervision with enforcement and, the sort of confessor role and then the enforcement role. I think that's a larger discussion of how well that works, and maybe they should be disaggregated. On conflicts of interest for the president, that is where I do disagree. I think that the reality is that the president is uninvolved in the vast majority of government decisions, that even some very high-profile decisions the president is at least supposed to stay out of, like whether to prosecute people. I know that is not the current occupant's philosophy necessarily, although there's not necessarily... an indication that that has been accepted by even his own Justice Department. I'm really having trouble understanding why recusing for the president, and his own cabinet does it all the time, Jeff Sessions did it, is such an insurmountable problem. There may be a smaller subset, for instance, related to national security, or other core things where it is not practical to ask the president to recuse, and at that point, you do start to look at divestment, and I agree with Kathleen that you become the leader of the free world It's a life-changing event. Jimmy Carter had to sell his peanut farm. chose to sell his peanut farm.
Right.
George H.W. Bush had many business interests. He divested from them. So I don't think it's too much to ask, and I think there is a way to expect presidents to come up with a plan. And I don't think the law should micromanage what the president does. I think the president, with the people advising her or him, should just be responsible for doing that.
And why don't that anticipates my next question. Why should the law not micromanage what the president does? And when we have proposals put forward, say there's a complete shift in the Congress and the administrations ahead that say, hey, we're going to put all of these ethics rules down and make sure that none of this happens again. What is the risk of overregulating?
Well, I would actually say that one of the issues is the more you get into Congress micromanaging the president's finances, like you can have this account, you can. I do think that there are then constitutional concerns raised. I think presidents are citizens. They're subject to the same laws as the rest of us. The conflict of interest law is a broad prohibition. So I don't believe there are constitutional concerns with subjecting the president to the conflict of interest law. I'm not quite as convinced if you're starting to like have Congress describe exactly what the president can or can't do. I think, like every other person in government, the president should have the obligation to comply and to figure out how he or she is going to comply. And then as a practical matter, Jimmy Carter probably didn't need to sell his peanut farm. I mean, that's nice that he did, maybe sad. I don't know. I've never asked. But I don't know that we need to force people to do that. And I do think that there's some truth, as you noted, not wanting. I roll my eyes a little bit at the not wanting to dissuade qualified people from running. Like, if it's really that big a drag to become leader of the free world, then fine, don't do it, you know. But, if it genuinely doesn't impact the public interest, or if there's a less burdensome way to solve the problem, I think that it's worth exploring that option. I understand President Trump has built a business that he's very proud of, and there are parts of that business that probably it could be solved by recusal instead of divestment. And there's no reason not to let him do that if it'll solve the problem.
Kathleen?
I want to get into some of the nitty-gritty of the financial conflict of interest statute. Walt and Dan may shine some light here that I think would help us understand how it would actually apply to the president. There are some matters that are so broad in scope that they're not even reached by the financial conflict of interest statute. So back in 1990, I believe it was, the George Herbert Walker Bush administration sought a legal opinion from the Justice Department, Office of Legal Counsel, to find out whether the U.S. response to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait implicated the financial conflict statute for members of the cabinet and others who have financial holdings in oil companies. And the Office of Legal Counsel, the Justice Department, indicated that the U.S. response to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait was so broad in scope that the financial conflict of interest statute was irrelevant. It didn't have to be considered by those cabinet members. And so what I want to flag is this possibility that it may be that most of what a president does is so broad in scope that the financial conflict statute has no application at all to those, policy proposals and decisions. On the other hand, I will tell you that if the president is getting involved in prosecution decisions of the Justice Department, that is something narrow enough that absolutely the financial conflict statute would apply. But of course, there are other reasons. The president should never be involved in specific criminal prosecution decisions. So I guess I would be interested in hearing from Dan and Walt on whether you have a handle on what percentage of the president's actual activities are likely to implicate the financial conflict statute if it applies to the president.
Since we have an audience with probably a wide range of background, I'll try to stay high level. But one of my concerns about applying the existing statute to the president, it's 18 U.S.C. Section 208, and we just refer to it as 208, is that 208 is a very blunt instrument that's at once overbroad and too narrow. And it turns, as you had said, there are some types of things that are covered by it and some that are not. And it's the difference between a matter, whatever that is not covered, and a particular matter is covered. And finding the line between a matter and a particular matter, what makes it particular enough? Well, the definition is a matter that is focused on the interests of a discrete and identifiable class of persons or parties. But in practical application, there are people who spend all day, every day, trying to figure out what is a particular matter and where is the line between matter and particular matter. And so some party matters are very narrow, like a litigation, like the prosecution you mentioned. But others are broader, for instance, a regulation affecting any industry. If it affects just one industry, that the members of that industry are a discrete and identifiable class of persons. But you get into a debate about whether new regulations for aspirin, this was an OLC opinion, would be a particular matter. And some people were arguing, well, it'll raise the price for all of the consumers, and all consumers in the world are not a discrete and identifiable class of persons. But then the decision was, well, but it focuses on the interests of the manufacturer, so it is. And that's a relatively clear-cut example. It gets really weird and drops off the edges. And at OGE, because the more difficult questions would filter up through a pyramid of 4,500 agency ethics officials, we got all of the most confusing, vague, right on the edge of the line, to the point where some days staff would lose faith and say, does any of this mean anything? Because it could be one way or the other. And I would remind them that 80% of the time it makes sense, but we're dealing with high-level officials who are involved in very unusual things, and we're living in that 20% where it's vague and probably more the 5% where it turns into quantum mechanics. And so part of the problem is the temptation would exist with a president who's behaving in, who's carrying out his conduct in the public eye more than any other government official, there would be great pressure to define that so narrowly. Anytime there was a debate, the White House would come out with detailed explanations of why it's not a particular matter. And they would probably co-opt the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel to engage in mental gymnastics to do a post hoc rationalization about what the president did is okay. And then that starts gutting the criminal conflict of interest statute for everyone else. And so I worry that at that top level, these vagaries can be exploited by a president and then ultimately undermine the law that applies to everybody else if the same law were to apply to them. And I could give you examples, but probably I'd wind up confusing myself and you, because we just had constant debates, including, for instance, after about 2007 or 8, we worked with the Department of Justice, and they concluded that a trade negotiation between two countries isn't automatically a particular matter, even though there are two parties, meaning the countries, because they're whole countries, and you have to look at the subject matter. And if it affects all aspects of the economy or a number of different sectors, it's not a particular matter, even though the thing that an individual government employee might work on is affecting only one industry. And so a president could manipulate trade negotiations to his or her benefit and not be covered by this particular statute, where in other areas they're overly covered because of the broad reach of that statute. So it's too broad and too narrow. And then the other thing is this statute requiring recusal only addresses conflicts of interest in the sense that a conflict of interest might influence your decision making. So you stay out of a matter, you recuse, and therefore you've resolved the conflict of interest. But it doesn't get at efforts to curry favor with a president by funneling money to them which we see with people being willing to pay double the membership fee over the past year at Mar-a-Lago, or the D.C. Trump International Hotel making a profit in its first year when it was expected to lose money, as most hotels do in their first year, not because it filled every room, but because the people who want to be there to rub elbows with White House officials who hang out in the bar there or the president who makes appearances there are willing to pay well above market rate for the same rooms. And so you have the danger of buying access or currying favor in addition to conflict of interest. And that's why, among other reasons, including this technical reason about the damage it might do to legal interpretation, I don't think recusal and subjecting the president to the normal recusal statute is the best option. The two options that I think are really more realistic are either a divestiture statute, because, again, this primary criminal conflict of interest statute is a recusal statute, meaning you have to stay out of things, not divest things. But if you have a divestiture statute, divestiture is stronger medicine than recusal, and so you'd have to have more exceptions for a president, and I could live with that. But I still think the better thing is to turn us back as a culture to voluntary compliance by reinjecting it into the political process at a point when people don't have to switch parties. Because a lot flows from the president's behavior. When a president has a disinterest in government ethics, not only does it undermine the public's faith in government, but it undermines government officials' faith in government, and that tempts them to misbehave. Because if the president can do it, if my boss can do it, why would I be held to a higher level standard than my boss? The higher up you go, the more power and influence you have, so the stricter the rules should be. If my boss can engage in nepotism and conflicts of interest and misuse his position to advertise his properties, then why should I, who has so much less authority than him, behave? And that becomes the thinking that starts corroding and corrupting government at all levels. And so if we can get back to being a country that is a model for all the rest of the world, and we used to get delegations coming to OGE to study our system, they don't, I think, admire us anymore. And we won't get there necessarily by legislation as much as I think, or at least as comprehensively as we would by creating an environment where people feel pressure to do the right thing.
Go ahead.
I do think, though, that you have to acknowledge, Walt, and that you alluded to this, there's a bell unringing problem here. So it would be nice to get back to the norms of George H.W. Bush, and that would be great. I don't know that anyone has a solid idea of how to do that. And I think that the law is not a perfect substitute, but the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. I happen to think that the Brennan Center has proposed extending conflict of interest law to the president. We've also proposed certain exceptions that we think would be appropriate for the president. There might be others. I tend to think, for instance, that, when the president signs legislation, that should just be accepted from the conflict statute because the president's role in the legislative process is indispensable, and he or she can't really do anything without Congress. So that particular function should not give rise to a conflict. I also think maybe a materiality threshold, which is a monetary threshold below which we just consider it not relevant, which a lot of states have in their conflict regimes, might also be appropriate. But I think that the devil is in the details and it's not perfect, but if we just say, we've got to get back to these norms, I'm just not sure in an era of hyperpolarization, when people just are very loyal to their party ID, I don't know that that's going to happen.
Now, I want to just say we're going to go to questions pretty soon. So if you have one, we do have a microphone set up right over here. I think we could also pass it if that's a better passable microphone as well. We also have one on both. Sorry, the light was blinding me. There's one on either side. And so just think of that, and you can head to the microphones to ask your question. But I'm going to ask one more, particularly as a newspaper reporter. I think about not just the president, but other people and whether there are reforms needed there. Can you talk a little bit about other people? Should we be concerned about Ivanka Trump wearing her own clothes or traveling to China when she has patent deals there? Should we be worried about Jared Kushner going to the Middle East to try to effect peace when there are Israeli investors in his companies? Who else should we be worried about?
I think the Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump problem stems from the original sin of the nepotism that was brought into the White House, because it's so uncommon for White House officials to retain as many assets as they retain, but nobody in the White House was willing to lean on them as hard as other officials because these were the president's own relatives. So I think we have a nepotism problem, but I think that we don't see other people retaining that level of financial interest. But I do think that the concern that Dan and Kathleen expressed about privately held companies that I agree with is universally applicable to everyone and is a dangerous gap. And I do think it makes sense to treat at least family privately held companies and possibly privately held companies differently than publicly traded companies.
Kathleen? No, I think that's a really key reform. This came up actually a few months ago when there were news stories related to, I think it was referred to as the Paradise Papers, and Secretary of Commerce and a member of Congress who had been involved, I believe, in the confirmation process didn't realize that our Secretary of Commerce was essentially in business with Russian oligarchs and Putin's son-in-law. Yeah. And he didn't realize that because that information was not apparent on the face of these disclosure forms. However, if Congress were to clarify propose and get adopted enhanced disclosure obligations, then someone like the Secretary of Commerce and others will have to disclose not just their ownership of LLCs, but the key customers of those LLCs and the financial relationships of those privately held LLCs, so that both the conflict of interest vetting people within the executive branch and Congress and the Senate will have access to the information that they need.
There is one dimension of this, though, that I think, and Kathleen, you've actually written very eloquently about this, and it's influenced my thinking, is that there is a temptation every time you have, after Watergate, for instance, to have sort of a wave of government ethics reform that which is why you lucky line attorney at DOJ, don't get a drink with someone who's going to buy it for you because you might have just run afoul of some rule. And I do think that we need to be mindful of the fact that, ordinary federal employees are already quite regulated. Mm-hmm. And, this is a situation that calls for targeted solutions and thoughtful solutions, yes. And possibly more to do with the machinery of administration enforcement with OGE than it does with a sort of another wave of omnibus ethics reform that's going to impose more restrictions on every low-level government employee. And it's something that I really came to by reading some of your scholarship, and I think it's an important point that we need to keep in mind.
And I just want to emphasize, so thank you, and I want to acknowledge how rare it is for scholarship to have any kind of impact at all. So I'm really grateful.
I have to agree that that's a really good point because, for example, we need smart reforms, but we don't just need more is more. Right now, a staff attorney at EPA could not go and represent on a pro bono basis a veteran who needs help with the Social Security Administration or the VA because there's a criminal conflict of interest statute that extends to the entire government and keeps them from representing people. And so I've never liked that application of the rule and wish it was to just your agency or agencies you have influence over. And so I think we have to be careful that there could be a wave of reforms where people just think more is more and they slather on a solution that's like a sledgehammer when a scalpel is needed.
Okay. I have a question right here.
Thank you very much. I'd really like to begin. My name is Shruti Shah. I work for Coalition for Integrity. I'd really like to begin by thanking you, Walter. Really, we admire the courage with which you stood up to authority, and you inspire many of us in the room.
I just want to make sure.
My question is really following on from what Kathleen said about this whole issue of LLCs. It's not just really the LLCs that are in the financial disclosure form, as she pointed out, that are the issue, where you really can't understand the liabilities. We've seen articles in BuzzFeed News last week and USA Today, which really point out that the majority of the Trump Organization's real estate sales have been to these secretive LLC companies, especially in the time since he became president. And we really don't really understand who the true beneficial owner is behind these shell companies, and we really can't unpackage who's trying to buy influence. So in that sense, taking this question, number one, is would better disclosure help, and really is disclosure enough? I'm beginning to think, listening to all three of you, that divesting completely is the answer, given all of these questions.
I want to give them a chance to respond. Go ahead. You can start, Kathleen.
Oh, well, no, I those BuzzFeed articles and USA Today articles and others about these transactions really identify a key problem that affects us in terms of government ethics and is actually a much broader problem society-wide in the United States regarding the lack of transparency with regard to real estate transactions in particular, not just LLCs, but the potential for money laundering and so on. So I guess, well, I absolutely think we need to be cautious about layering on additional government ethics standards because more is not always better. I will say that this area of real estate transactions and the lack of transparencies with regard to LLCs generally, not just with regard to government officials, is a really key problem that we need action on.
Walt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I haven't heard any proposals from anyone that would require a company to disclose its customers. So I'm not even sure there's a proposal out there that would get at this. And yet, as you point out, it's a very serious problem that we don't know who is funneling money to the president or for what purpose, and are they paying market rate or above market rate or above what the thing is actually worth. This is, again, goes back to my concern that I don't know that you solve the problem without divestiture, because you have so much potential for things to flow to a president, particularly through these privately held companies. I'd be less worried if they held stock in GM and GM was selling off some of its property or assets. And I don't know that I feel the need to know who they're selling them off to, because it's a big enough company that I don't think decisions are being made to benefit a president. But these privately held companies that he holds are then selling to privately held companies that obscure the buyer. And you already have the articles you mentioned, and I think if people missed it, because I didn't see it getting as much coverage as it should, a group called Global Witness worked with Reuters to release a really damning report on money laundering activities. And I don't think they ever alleged that he was personally involved in money laundering, but that this was going on in these types of businesses seems to be the implication of their report. And now we have a president who's at least adjacent to this activity, and it makes him vulnerable to blackmail or to funneling of money to him. And we have no way of gathering the information because these privately held companies are not required to disclose it.
Just to follow on, I just wanted to add one small point.
Just very quickly. Very quickly, one point.
There are six bills in Congress that address anonymous companies, so we really do need to pay attention to that issue. And secondly, I mean, the real estate issue requiring real estate companies in the real estate business, agents or otherwise, to do due diligence, I mean, that doesn't even require an act of Congress. That's just rulemaking by Treasury.
Okay. Again, so did you want to talk
just very, very
that
quickly?
Down.
I two things. One is the LLC problem is huge. It's actually central. The Brennan Center is based in New York, and it is the LLCs are central to New York's crisis of corruption. They were central to the several large scandals. I do believe in transparency, and I do think that some combination of transparency rules and recusal rules or divestment rules can be effective. And again, I just want to come back to not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. I don't think that transparency is meaningless. I think it can make a big difference.
Okay, and it was my fault for not saying that our questioner should say who your name is, right, and also make your one point question.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, that takes care of one. My name is Bill Hillegeist. I actually had two questions. One's easy. The Office of Government Ethics renders opinions. Are they compulsory or voluntary for those to follow? Number two, can somebody explain the rationale of the GSA decision to allow the Trump Organization to maintain the tenant agreement at the Post Office Department?
Well, the first question's a lot easier than the second, so I'll dive in on that one. OGE's opinions are interpretive, and so it's not really a matter of compulsory or non-compulsory. OGE is taking the position that this is what the law means, at least in terms of its legal opinions. Now, it also issues some program advisories where it gives instructions to agencies, and it has taken the position that it can direct agencies to do things like produce documents or change the way they track things, or we recently required them to start using the electronic financial disclosure system unless they applied for a waiver to that. But in terms of the legal opinions, those are interpretive, and OGE coordinates with the Department of Justice when it involves the criminal statutes, and OGE cannot bind the Department of Justice, so they could still prosecute somebody, but you could talk a prosecutor out of prosecuting you probably if you were able to say, I relied on this opinion. So as a practical matter, they have the effect of being compulsory because they're your best guidance on what the law is. But again, they're not written as orders to go and do something.
On the GSA question, regarding GSA's interpretation of the lease for the Trump Hotel here, the GSA's interpretation is nonsensical.
That's a good way to
put it. I want to acknowledge that the decision was actually not, to me, interesting. It was not actually written by a lawyer at GSA. I believe it was written by a contracting official. I want to emphasize that the nonsensibility of it really wouldn't depend on a law degree or any kind of legal education. But on the other hand, I am intrigued by the fact that it wasn't, I'm a teacher of legal ethics, and it's, so perhaps for that reason, I'm intrigued by the fact that it wasn't touched or not apparently touched by a lawyer, but made by a contract officer. It just doesn't make any sense because it asserts that the president will not benefit from the lease because he won't actually receive the benefit until after he leaves office. But to suggest that that's not a benefit is, as I say, nonsensical.
I mean, I'm math illiterate completely, but even and finance illiterate too. God help me. But even I know what a capital account is, and I know that just because you don't take distributions from your capital account doesn't mean that it's somehow not yours. Still, so if the money, the profits from the hotel are going into his capital account, the capital account is going up, and that basically, they, as Kathleen said, it was that because the money wouldn't actually go out until after he leaves office, he wasn't benefiting.
I would add an adjective. It's not only nonsensical, it's surly, because there's one place in it where it sort of mocks what it takes as the outside world's black and white reading of the very plain language. Just a quick funny story. Shortly before the inauguration, GSA was issuing these press statements saying, well, OGE decides ethical issues, not us. And I got so mad that they were sicking the press on us over this that I called them up and said, if you want me to make that decision, I'll do it today. But unless you're giving me the authority to make the decision, you stop issuing these press releases that we have control over this outcome. Because if I've got a control over it, I know what I'm going to decide. And they changed their press statement.
All right, go ahead. Yeah.
My name is Li Yang. Thanks for your presentation. I'm thinking that ethic rule not only apply to the current president, but and not only apply to the conflict of interest directly violation. I'm thinking that for all the profession, if there are irresponsibility and there is falling outside the ethic rule, and so they should be prosecuted too. So I just wonder, is there anything in our government really say the professional, especially the DOJ, if they don't prosecute the right person, that means they are benefited indirectly. So this, to me, is a violation of ethic rule. So is there anything that somewhere people should speak up and say they got to stop.
Well, I think your sentiment is right that this should stop. Unfortunately, it's a question of the difference between common sense ethics and the legal statutes that create the framework for ethics. And unless there's a specific criminal law that you violate, you can't be prosecuted. And so, interestingly, this administration itself acknowledged this concept in a letter that OMB's Mick Mulvaney issued after Secretary Price lost his job for horsing around on luxury jets. And they had a line in there that said, just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. And I almost keeled over laughing because this is what I'd been saying to this administration all along, and they'd been telling me I was out of line. At least they heard it well enough to parrot it. They just aren't living into it. But so I think maybe the answer is just because somebody's not going to be prosecuted doesn't mean the behavior is acceptable. I meant to say this earlier on something else we were saying, but I think it relates here with regard to prosecution, because one of the areas that we've seen the norms break down is with the president interfering with the Department of Justice, whether it's interviewing U.S. attorney applicants for the districts that he has properties in, or having Don McGahn, the White House counsel, go out to find out if there's a secret FISA warrant, or calling for the prosecution of his rivals. There's a real susceptibility to political influence on prosecution in our country. And so I think we benefit from this line where you can't be prosecuted just because it's wrong. You have to actually violate a statute, because the potential for abuse in the other direction would be terrible. Because then the president's in charge and he could decide who he doesn't like and have Jim Acosta of CNN prosecuted because he asked him a hard question that was on everybody's mind. Interestingly, though, in the early to mid-2000s, OGE is part of these international anti-corruption mechanisms, and some of them do reviews of each other's countries. And the feedback the U.S. kept getting was that prosecutors don't have enough independence in our country and are too vulnerable to political influence. And at the time, it made no sense to me, and I thought that sounded crazy. I think we now see what they were talking about when the international community was expressing concern that the criminal investigative apparatus of our country could be abused for political reasons, because these prosecutors report to political appointees and ultimately to the president. So I think we want to be careful not to go necessarily beyond the bounds of law when it comes to imposing punishments, but in terms of demanding that people live up to the ethical traditions, I don't think that's too much to ask.
Okay, I want to get to the next question, a quick one-point question if you can, and let us know who you are.
Sure. Chase Gunner, I'm a reporter with FCW. I wanted to ask, are there two sets of rules for the bureaucracy and the politicos in the White House? And, Walter, you touched on this. What concerns do you have, or how long before the sort of way the Trump administration operates ethically trickles down to, say, procurement officers or lower-level government employees?
So there are two sets of rules, but the good news is that there are rules that apply to everybody, and then there are a few additional rules that apply to the higher-level political appointees. So while the president and the vice president are exempt, political appointees have all of the normal rules plus some bans. Some things like a ban on outside earned income. And so that's okay. I don't think we have this problem except for the president and the vice president being exempted from statutes. And in terms of individual procurement officials, I think I still have confidence that all of the normal apparatuses in place for the career level employees are so far holding with no indication of change. I mean, there's, in a workforce of millions of people, you're always going to have the occasional bad egg. But so far, I haven't seen widespread trickle down to the level of violating procurement rules. Now, part of the reason for that is you can have bid protests, and there's actual enforcement mechanisms where the injured parties can hold the government accountable and undo a contract. So I think that is good. Now, unfortunately, I think one of the most sinister things out there is this phrase, deep state, because what they're calling deep state are people who have a firm belief in the rule of law and the structures in place to protect the integrity of the government, like procurement officials who are not going to obey instructions from above to taint procurement, but instead are going to insist on the normal rules. It sounds a little bit to me, if any of you are the fans of The Office, like Michael Scott complaining about Toby being the wet blanket and saying we have rules. And so I think that denigrates what actually is one of the best things about our government, is that we have people who no matter what are going to follow the rules, even if their bosses are pushing otherwise.
Kathleen?
If I could respond, I want to underscore something that you said earlier, Walter. When you were talking about the pressure that would be placed on the Justice Department to interpret the financial conflict statute in a really lax way if that statute applied to the president, we actually have seen that dynamic. And we've seen it with regard to the Justice Department's current interpretation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause. Because the Justice Department has taken a really strong line up until the Trump administration that the Foreign Emoluments Clause absolutely prohibits for value exchanges between a government official and a foreign government, prohibiting a U.S. official from receiving compensation for services provided. No indication that it's just limited to gifts. But now in litigation, the Justice Department, now that the Foreign Emoluments Clause is in litigation and at issue, it interprets the Foreign Emoluments Clause more narrowly than it has before, so that it wouldn't apply to for value exchanges with government officials. And that's not limited to the president. That would, you know, weakens the Foreign Emoluments Clause as interpreted by the Justice Department to all federal officials.
I just would say that illustrates one of the things in our report that we pointed out, is the Justice Department in particular, I do not think is the best enforcer of these rules. This is why I think you need to have some sort of independent ethics regulator, because for a variety of reasons, not just actually the subservience to the president, the Justice Department is just not well suited for this.
Okay, we just have a couple minutes left, so you get our last question.
Rudy Mirabani from the Brennan Center for Justice. I'm going to pick up on this point, because having served at agencies and having witnessed, or should I say, having heard of some of these conversations that contracting officers, designated agency ethics officials participate in with their bosses, can get uncomfortable, to say the least, at times. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad you mentioned our private jet hopping cabinet members. I'm wondering if you think it's important, and if you thought about any additional protections, maybe something along the lines of what, Walt, you mentioned for the director of OGE, to apply to those folks at executive branch agencies who are actually looked upon to approve actions taken by either senior political officers or certify their actions, that those officials then use as cover when justifying why they did what they did.
You know, I think Rudy's question puts a nice nuance on something I said in response to your question. I said I don't think it's trickled down to the point where procurement decisions are affected. I would say, though, that procurement decisions are the very last thing that will be affected, because private companies can sue if they get cheated out of a contract bid. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have rules for which there's no outside oversight and consequence. And Rudy gave the good example. The travel rules had some subjective requirements. And career officials and lower-level political appointees worked together to come up with these decisions, saying it's okay to take this fabulously luxurious charter jet to go the distance from D.C. to Philly, even though you have to drive an hour out to Dulles Airport, and the drive to Philly is only 2.5 hours, so we could have saved money by sending you by an Uber. There, I think we have seen some corrupting influence, because these people assume they'd operate in darkness. And my group filed a FOIA request, the Campaign Legal Center, filed a FOIA request for GSA for these travel reports, because all agencies are required to file them there. And GSA gave the sleaziest response. They say, oh, no, you have to request it from each of the agencies, even though we have it all here, and denied the request. It was just despicable. And so I think these people thought they were going to operate in darkness. And And then a couple of reporters from Politico, Dan Diamond and Rachna Prada, were staking out an airport and caught Secretary Price. And suddenly, these decisions are exposed to the public, and IGs now in two agencies have said the documentation is inadequate, and these people just said, oh, yes, I find it meets this standard, and they just restated the standard without justifying it. So I think there's some real danger for that. And I even saw a distinction among agency ethics officials where some stood their ground and tried to apply the same standards to these incoming appointees who had gotten the message from their boss that ethics doesn't matter, and others just cave like whatever. I can't think of a good analogy. Whatever caves. And and I found myself having to give them pep talks or snarl or bang my fist, whatever I could do to coax, cajole, bully, beg, plead them to hold these folks to the same standards that they held people in the Bush administration and people in the Obama administration, because they were so intimidated by a perceived ruthlessness of a group of people who, for instance, asked the Department of Energy to provide a list of everybody who'd worked on climate change issues and feared retaliation. So I think in answer to your question, Rudy, it would be nice if there were more protections along the lines of whistleblower-type protections, except this isn't quite whistleblowing, and I don't have my mind around exactly how we would enforce it. One way might be for each individual requirement, create some transparency provisions so at least they're not operating in darkness. And one thing that I proposed to Congress, for instance, was just to have GSA post all of these travel reports on its website and require a little bit more information to be put in there, like why did you choose a charter jet as opposed to a first class ticket? Yeah. So I think the key is to look for enforcement mechanisms or at least transparency mechanisms.
Kathleen.
And one of the accountability mechanisms that could come into play here, and I think is important to ensure, is whistleblower protection. Because a government official's disclosure that such a proposed trip would violate the ethics standards could well qualify for whistleblower protection under the Whistleblower Protection Act. And so that's one of the things that I think we need to look for to make sure that the robust protection for whistleblower protections that we actually have seen under Carolyn Lerner as special counsel that continues.
Dan, the last word is yours, if you want it.
So, last word, are we?
Yes, we are wrapping up.
Okay, so, first of all, I want to again thank my co-panelists on behalf of the Brennan Center for participating in this. I think it was a really wonderful discussion. I just, building off of that, want to end with two things. One is that, these issues that have come up with this administration are related. So whistleblower protections, ethics, limits on presidential power, it's important to think of it as a holistic package. And one of the things that's going to be a challenge for people in the years ahead is trying to, like the dam that sprouts many leaks, figure out how to tackle sort of the whole as opposed to its various constituent parts, which is there's a siloing tendency that I think people are going to have to fight against. The second thing I want to emphasize again, which I've said, is that we at the Brennan Center, I know, are very committed to the idea that the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. None of these solutions is without drawbacks. And so as the debate continues, you have to factor in, again, that nothing is going to solve all of these problems. But at the same time, you can make progress. And then the last thing I guess I'm going to say is just that, again, a lot of this discussion has been about President Trump. That's true, but there's more. Our democracy is bigger than any one public official. And these are rules that are going to be with us long after this president is gone and the next president as well. So the more we can think about what's in our country's long-term interests and divorce it from anger at what you might perceive as the particular excesses of this administration, I think the better.
All right. On behalf of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU here in D.C., I'd like to thank all of you here in D.C. for joining us live in the audience, as well as those who joined us via live stream or via C-SPAN. And I'd like to ask those of you who are here to join me in thanking one last time Walt, Kathleen, and Dan for this great discussion.
And our excellent moderator. Thank you very much.